content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the edition dated February 3rd, 2012. And we'll begin our reading today with the main article from the main story section entitled Obama's Populist Case for His Re-Election. What happened? President Obama used his State of the Union address this past week to frame his re-election campaign as a battle for the middle class, calling income inequality the defining issue in the United States and asking the rich to pay their fair share of taxes. The president said that anyone earning over $1 million should pay at least 30% in taxes, a proposal he named the Buffett Rule after the billionaire investor who famously complained that he paid lower taxes than his secretary. Added revenue from higher taxes on the rich, Obama said, could be used to reduce the deficit and reduce cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and other social programs. You can call this class warfare all you want, he said, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes, most Americans would call that common sense. Striking an optimistic and distinctly populist tone, Obama said recent job growth reports show that the economy is recovering and outlined proposals that he said would create an America built to last. He proposed tax breaks for businesses that manufacture their products in the U.S. and using money we're no longer spending on war to rebuild infrastructure and develop the clean energy industry. He also announced a plan to allow underwater homeowners who owe more on their mortgages than their houses are worth to refinance at reduced rates. In the Republican rebuttal, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels said Obama's proposals to spend more money and micromanage the economy would lead to national bankruptcy, and he castigated him for his constant efforts to divide us. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Obama didn't give us a State of the Union, said the New York Post, so much as a state of my campaign. He made it clear he intends to win this election by taking a page out of the Occupy Wall Street playbook and blaming the wealthy for America's problems instead of his failed presidency. What else can he say, said the Wall Street Journal. Obama can't run on his failed stimulus spending or the unpopular Obamacare overhaul of the health care system, nor can he claim credit for the weakest recovery since the Great Depression. The politics of envy is all he's got left. Yes, it was a campaign speech, said the Baltimore Sun, but given the state of Washington, what else could we expect? Few, if any, of Obama's policies have any hope of being made law thanks to Republican obstruction. Yet, as the president pointed out, the economy has added 3 million jobs since the Great Recession, which began during a Republican administration. We've come too far to turn back now, Obama said, a theme that will define his bid for re-election. Now here's what the columnist said. What a difference a year makes, said Jonathan Cohn in the NewRepublic.com. This time last year, Obama, humbled by his midterm election shellacking, used the State of the Union as a plea for bipartisanship. It didn't get him anywhere. This year, buoyed by the slowly recovering economy, he threw down the gauntlet to Republicans and laid the groundwork for a second-term agenda, sure to please a majority. Most voters like public works, they like a secure welfare state, and they like higher taxes on the rich. Given our monstrous deficits, said Rich Lowry in FoxNews.com, Obama's pandering was deeply cynical. He made no concrete proposals to transform our hideously complex code, or to reduce our groaning Social Security and Medicare costs, or our $1.3 trillion annual deficit. This speech was so lightweight it could have floated off the teleprompter. It all boiled down to a single message, said Burton Folsom in NationalReview.com. We need bigger government, and more of it should be paid for by rich people. Obama did do a lot of pandering to the prejudices of the electorate, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But he tried for more than 2 years to be a pragmatic policy wonk and saw his popularity drain away as Republicans blocked and battered him at every turn. This was the speech of a president who knows his agenda is dead, leaving him with one option to recast himself as a slashing populist and win re-election. And the next item from the main story section of the Week magazine, Gingrich, Romney, and the battle for Florida. What happened? As the focus in the Republican presidential nomination race narrowed to two candidates, Mitt Romney this past week responded to Newt Gingrich's 12-point win in the South Carolina primary by amping up his attacks on the former House Speaker. At a debate in Florida, which will hold its primary next week, and of course that primary has been held, and candidate Mitt Romney was a substantial winner there. We'll have details about that next week. But Romney called Gingrich a failed leader who resigned in disgrace as Speaker in 1998 after being fined $300,000 for ethics violations. He accused Gingrich of later working as an influence peddler in Washington, noting that he was paid $1.6 million to advise Freddie Mac at the same time the mortgage giant was costing the people of Florida millions upon millions of dollars. Gingrich denied that he had ever worked as a lobbyist, called Romney's attacks the worst kind of trivial politics. The fierce battle continued on Florida's airwaves with a pro-Gingrich super PAC spending $6 million on ads claiming that Romney invented government-run health care as governor of Massachusetts. Romney also sought to end speculation over his financial affairs by releasing his 2010 tax returns and an estimate for 2011. He paid $3 million in taxes on $21.7 million of income in 2010, putting his effective tax rate below 14%. I paid all the taxes owed, Romney said, and not a penny more. Now, here's what the editorial said. Romney's returns highlight exactly what's wrong with our tax system, said the New York Daily News. The candidate is in the top 0.0025% of all earners, but pays a lower rate than many middle-class families. Romney has rejected Obama's proposed hike in top earners' tax rates, but that stance could cost him dearly if he wins the GOP nomination, as Obama will depict him as the personification and beneficiary of unfairness. Romney isn't cheating the tax man one bit, said the Boston Herald. His effective tax rate is closer to 45% since much of his income comes from investments that have already been subjected to a 35% corporate tax rate, the highest in the world, by the way. All Romney is guilty of is working hard and investing wisely. Now here's what the columnist said. Romney has lost his strongest asset, his aura as the GOP's inevitable nominee and the candidate most likely to beat Obama, said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMag.com. The attacks on his venture capitalism and tax status have had a huge impact. 2 weeks ago, he was viewed unfavorably by 34% of voters. Now it's 49%. Among independents whose votes he'll need to win the White House, the figure is even worse. 51% hold negative views of Romney, compared with 43% for Obama. Most voters just don't believe that this Mormon multimillionaire can understand their lives, said Chris Galiza in WashingtonPost.com. And revelations about his exotic financial arrangements, including investments in tax havens like Luxembourg and the Cayman Islands, will only alienate him further from ordinary Americans. There is nothing more dangerous in politics than otherness, and Romney reeks of it. That's why Gingrich will win the nomination, said Michael Walsh in NationalReview.com. The former speaker understands that the base doesn't want some establishment-approved milquetoast candidate, but one who's itching for a fight with everything the Obama Democrats stand for. A Gingrich-Obama showdown would be like a prize fight between a puncher and a boxer, and if heavyweight Newt lands a blow on the nimble but insubstantial Obama, it's lights out. I'm afraid that's wishful thinking, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. Americans might be eager to replace Obama, but not with either of these clowns. Gingrich is entertaining in debates, but he's far too histrionic and erratic to inspire confidence. The robotic Romney stands for nothing and is self-destructed with his inept defense of his time at Bain Capital and his foolish resistance to releasing his tax returns. With candidates like this, Republicans deserve to lose. Those of us who despair of a second Obama term can only hope Obamacare is repealed by the High Court, the Iranian bomb is repealed by the Israeli Air Force, and the Senate switches hands. Now, continuing in the main story section from the Week magazine, our controversy of the week, super PACs funding the dirtiest campaign ever. Brace yourself, America, said Joe Hagan in New York, for the coming tsunami of slime. Thanks to our Supreme Court, whose notorious Citizens United decision 2 years ago this week opened the door for wealthy individuals and corporations to spend unlimited sums on political advertising. The 2012 election will be the dirtiest in history, with so-called super PACs slinging most and the worst of the mud. These shadowy organizations are supposedly barred from coordinating directly with candidates, but that just gives them greater freedom to peddle personal attacks and outright lies while their candidates retain a veneer of deniability. In the GOP primary, we've already seen a pro-Mitt Romney super PAC destroy Newt Gingrich's poll lead in Iowa in a matter of days with a barrage of attack ads. In South Carolina, Newt jumped back into contention with a pro-Gingrich super PAC, led a blistering attack on Romney's venture capital company. For the general election, Republican and Democratic super PACs are hiring dozens of opposition researchers to collect video and dirt on Barack Obama and his eventual opponent. With as much as $3 billion to be spent on the race, expect even more punishing waves of negative campaigning. So what, said Bradley Smith in the Wall Street Journal, freedom of speech, of political speech in particular, is the cornerstone of our democracy. Those bemoaning the rise of the super PAC are mostly liberals who are alarmed that, so far at least, Democratic super PACs are being out-fundraised and outspent by their Republican rivals. For all their talk of fairness and democracy, so-called reformers want to silence voices they perceive to be hostile. Strange how these reformers don't care that some giant corporations, those that own newspapers, TV networks, and other media, are free to spend whatever they like to influence elections, said David Harsanyi in the Denver Post. Why should only media corporations enjoy unfettered speech? As for the super PACs, dirty campaign ads, I don't share the reformers' belief that most voters are gullible, hapless, and easily manipulated. The ads have actually focused attention on Romney's and Gingrich's records, information voters clearly find useful. You're ignoring the problem of corruption, said Fred Wertheimer in Politico.com. Gambling magnate Sheldon Adelson, a pro-Israeli Uber hawk, has written $5 million checks to the super PAC supporting Gingrich. Does anyone really believe that Gingrich's views on gambling or the Mideast won't be powerfully influenced if this single billionaire helps him get elected? Of course not, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com, which is why many citizens are now fighting back against the extraordinary damage to our democracy caused by the super PACs. With polls showing that 62% of the public is opposed to the Citizens United decision, momentum is building for a constitutional amendment to reverse the ruling and ban big money in politics once and for all. That's a futile pursuit, said E.D. Kane in the Atlantic.com. Reformers have tried and failed to keep big money out of politics. Money flows regardless of whatever leaky legal dams we erect. So let the money flow, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. The result may be ugly and noisy, but it's better than the government deciding what its citizens can and cannot hear. I am comfortable with dirty politics. I fear living with less free speech. And now from the main story section, we will switch to the very popular feature here called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 from the Week magazine. It was a good week for buying your boss a treadmill after a Northern Illinois University study found that managers who exercise regularly are noticeably less nasty than those who don't. It was a good week for drinking on the job. After the Florida Department of Law Enforcement revealed that it had spent $330 on alcohol mixers and Doritos for 15 employees to get drunk. The department says it was testing the accuracy of its breathalyzers. And it was a good week for irony after passengers who were on the Costa Concordia said that the Celine Dion song My Heart Will Go On, the theme song of the 1997 film Titanic, was playing in one of the Italian cruise ship's restaurants when it hit a rock and began to sink. It was a bad week for making amends, though, after owners of Costa Concordia offered survivors of the ordeal a 30% discount on their next cruise if they want to stay loyal to the company. And it was a bad week for John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, after he broke his nose and suffered two black eyes while playing ice hockey. He must feel like Mitt Romney after South Carolina, said his spokeswoman. It was a bad week for rewriting history after Tennessee Tea Party activists demanded that the state legislature change curricula and textbooks to omit negative views of the founding fathers. Teachers should stop repeating an awful lot of made-up criticism about, for instance, the founders intruding on the Indians or having slaves or being hypocrites, said a Tea Party spokesman. And now we'll turn to our section of the Week magazine having to do with people. The first item this week is entitled The Trials of Being the Hoff. David Hasselhoff is annoyed that Hollywood doesn't take him more seriously, said Simon Lewis in the London Daily Mail. He was, after all, in two of the most successful TV series of the last century, Knight Rider and Baywatch. But critics never gave me any credit, he says. I would have liked to have been in ER, but you know, I was stuck with two legendary shows, which I can't complain about because no one remembers ER. It is, however, some consolation that he remains famous all over the world. I went to a Zulu village and everyone in the tribe knew me. The inspirational lyrics to his 1989 pop song, Looking for Freedom, a number one hit in West Germany, even helped bring down the Berlin Wall. I went to East Germany last year, and they were saying, thank you for the fall of the wall. The only problem with being a legend is that fans constantly mob him. A quiet night out with his girlfriend, Haley Roberts, a 32-year-old shop assistant from Wales, can turn into pandemonium. The other night, I went to her sister's office party. It was a nightmare. He brings up a picture on his phone of 50 screaming women surrounding him. And that was just me sitting at my table trying to have dinner. The next item from the People section, the end of Evert's love match. Chris Evert admits she made a mess out of her personal life, said Liz Clark in the Washington Post. On the tennis court, Evert rarely made a wrong move after bursting onto the scene at age 16, going on to win 18 Grand Slam singles championships. But the qualities that made her a tennis champ, the competitiveness and self-absorption, didn't translate to healthy love matches. Relationships are give and take, and when you're a tennis player, you're certainly not giving, says Evert, 57. It has to be about you. Her first marriage to tennis player John Lloyd lasted 5 years. When they split, she found happiness with former Olympic skier Andy Mill, with whom she had 3 sons. But during their 18-year marriage, Evert says, they drifted apart, and she let herself fall for his friend and business partner, golfer Greg Norman. Evert wed Norman in 2008, but their marriage was doomed from the start. Once I got married to Greg, the reality hit me, the guilt and the sadness I had caused my family. They divorced 15 months later. Evert still feels regret over the pain she caused, but says she's learned a lot of life lessons. When you're famous at 16, the rules change for you. You miss out on a lot of growing up and a lot of reality checks, she says. I'm a late bloomer. The next item, Williams' lost soulmate. Michelle Williams always knew that she'd lose Heath Ledger, said Chris Heath in GQ. She met the actor on the set of Brokeback Mountain in 2004 and instantly fell in love. The circumstances were cosmic, said Williams, who is 31. She was soon pregnant with their daughter Matilda. A lot happened at once. It's a bit like we had a lot of things to do because we didn't have a lot of time. Their relationship ended 3 years later, and in 2008, Ledger died of an overdose. Small comforts helped her through the heartache. I spent a lot of time taking baths, a lot of tea and baths, double warm. She often wonders what would have happened if Ledger had lived, would they have gotten back together? It's one of my favorite things to imagine, she says, through tears. William spent much of the past 3 years searching for a new life partner. I really expected that Matilda would have siblings that were close to her age, she says, but I couldn't make that happen. And now that she's 6, that isn't even a possibility anymore. For whatever reason, that's not our luck or our path. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to our section entitled The Briefing. The title this week is Showdown Over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has threatened to block the world's busiest oil shipping route. What would happen if the strait were closed? Why is the Strait of Hormuz so important? A narrow strip of water separating Iran from Oman. The strait is the major maritime link between the oil-rich Persian Gulf region and the rest of the world. Tankers carry 17 million barrels of oil, about a fifth of the world's supply, through the channel every day. 5 of the planet's biggest oil producers, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates, rely on the waterway to ship almost all of their energy exports. The waterway is now at the center of the West's increasingly tense standoff with Iran, which in recent weeks has warned that it would shut the shipping artery if the U.S. or Europe tightened economic sanctions in response to its nuclear program. Iran's top naval commander, Habibullah Sayari, said closing the strait would be easier than drinking a glass of water. The Obama administration has publicly dismissed the threat as saber-rattling, but sent word to Tehran through back channels that closing the strait would cross a red line and provoke an American military response. Could Iran actually shut down the strait? The simple answer is yes, they can block it, said General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Over the past 2 decades, Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard has stockpiled at least 2,000 naval mines. Those garbage can-sized explosives could be slipped into the water by midget submarines and civilian dhows and other fishing vessels. Although the waterway is 21 miles wide, Iran could make the strait a no-go zone for big vessels by laying mines across the deep central passage that holds the inbound and outbound shipping lanes, which are each only 2 miles wide. That operation could be completed in a matter of hours. All the Iranians have to do is say that they mine the strait and all tanker traffic would cease immediately. said John Rosamond, editor of the journal Jane's Navy International. Has Iran ever acted on its threats? Iran has tried to sabotage shipping during its decade-long conflict with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. When Iraq began attacking Iranian tankers in 1984, Iran responded by targeting vessels headed to and from Gulf ports and laying mines in shipping lanes. The frigate USS Samuel B. Roberts almost sank after it hit an Iranian mine in 1988, leading President Reagan to order retaliatory strikes. In a single day, the U.S. Navy destroyed two Iranian oil platforms, a frigate, a gunboat, and three speedboats. Today, Iran's Navy is a more formidable enemy. Not only does it have an arsenal of mines 10 times more powerful than those used in the 1980s, but it now boasts hundreds of advanced cruise missiles and possibly more than 1,000 small fast-track craft, U.S. Navy Commander Daniel Dolan wrote in a 2010 report. How would oil prices react? They'd skyrocket. Energy analysts warn that even a partial blockage of the strait could send the price of a barrel of oil soaring to $150, up from about $100 today. Gas prices in the U.S. would quickly rise above $4.50 a gallon and imperil the global economic recovery. But the Islamic Republic itself would likely pay the highest price for closing the strait. The Iranian government generates 65% of its revenues from oil exports, almost all of which pass through the waterway. Shutting off that cash stream would devastate Iran's economy, which is already reeling from international sanctions and mismanagement. By delivering on their threat, said Dennis Ross, a former White House advisor on the Mideast, the Iranians would basically be taking a vow of poverty. Why could the U.S., or what could the U.S. do to reopen the strait? It can't just send in minesweepers. Any warship entering the narrow waterway could be easily surrounded by swarms of missile-armed Iranian speedboats and targeted by anti-ship cruise missiles hidden on Iran's coastline, islands, and oil platforms. So the U.S. would likely begin any mine-clearing mission by launching aerial attacks on Iran's naval bases and missile silos. Since that would essentially put the two nations in a state of war, the U.S. would probably go further and embark on a broader offensive against the Islamic Republic. You'd almost certainly also see serious strikes on their nuclear facilities, said Anthony Kordsman, a defense expert at Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies. Once the Iranians have initiated hostilities, there is no set level at which you have to stop escalation. So will Iran really close the strait? Probably not. Most analysts think Iran will find less dangerous ways to dissuade the West from approving new sanctions. If they wanted to disrupt shipping, they could temporarily shut part of the strait for military exercises or launch one-off hit-and-run attacks they could then blame on pirates. But Iran's calculation would change if the U.S. or Israel launched a bombing attack on its nuclear facilities. Then a Hormuz shutdown would happen pretty much automatically, said Henry Smith of London-based security consultancy Control Risks. The Iranians have been saying for a long time that is an option, and they would have little choice but to stick to that. And the footnote to the showdown over the Strait of Hormuz this week is entitled Sending in the Dolphins. If Iran shuts the Strait of Hormuz, the U.S. will likely deploy its best mine detector, Flipper. The Navy has an 80-strong squad of bottlenose dolphins, some of which have been trained to find mines and mark their location by dropping an acoustic transponder. Navy divers are then sent in to destroy the explosives. The dolphins' incredible natural sonar makes them perfect minesweepers. They can distinguish between a nickel and a dime at 100 yards and among brass, aluminum, and stainless steel, even when the metal is buried under 2 feet of mud. They are astounding in their ability to detect underwater objects, said retired Admiral Tim Keating. Those skills have undoubtedly saved the lives of U.S. military personnel. During the 2003 invasion of Iraq, 9 Navy dolphins helped clear more than 100 mines and underwater booby traps placed by Saddam Hussein's forces. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we will take a look at the columns deemed the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine. The first one is entitled, "The GOP Needs to Draft an Alternative," by Arthur Davis, NationalReview.com. To avoid a November catastrophe, said Arthur Davis, Republicans should draft Jeb Bush as their presidential nominee. The bitter primary fight between Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney will likely be protracted, leaving two candidates so bruised that neither remains competitive with Obama. Jeb Bush, whose reform-oriented conservatism made him a highly popular governor in Florida, is the only available Republican who might still be pressed into running. A hero of the conservative base, Bush would also have broad appeal to the general electorate because of his successful efforts in Florida to reform education, rein in medical tort liability, and turn the state into a national laboratory for controlling health care costs. He's popular with seniors, Jewish voters, and, as the husband of a Mexican-American, Hispanics. Jeb presumably chose not to run this year because of lingering negativity about the last Bush presidency. But it's the Obama presidency that's now the issue, and the GOP can't afford to wait until 2016 for one of its brightest stars to run. Bush should measure his reluctance against the risks looming for his party and, potentially, his country. The next column is entitled "The End of the Christian Right" by Michael Kazin in The New Republic. The Christian right is a fading force in American life, said Michael Kazin. For more than two decades, conservative Christianity has had a powerful hold on the Republican Party, but this once monolithic political movement is now fighting a losing battle with the rest of the country. Despite vehement opposition by evangelicals, public support for same-sex marriage now tops 50% in national polls. Two-thirds of Americans have endorsed the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. A majority of Americans continue to support legal abortion in the early months of pregnancy, and it's unlikely that a Republican president would ever sign a law that could lead to the indictment of millions of women. The old Christian coalition is now run by aging, largely faceless men whose Old Testament worldview has little appeal to the increasingly secular population under 30. Even evangelicals under 30 care more about hunger and poverty than abortion and homosexuality. The Christian right may still play a role in a handful of states, but the sun is setting on its national influence. And the next column is entitled "Why Rubio Isn't a Hero to Latinos" by Ruben Navarrete, Jr. in the Dallas Morning News. Many Latinos believe that the Republican Party is hostile to their presence in America, said Ruben Navarrete, Jr. The GOP now thinks it has a magic elixir to cure this problem, and his name is Marco Rubio. Florida's popular young senator, a Cuban-American, is sure to be on the shortlist for a vice presidential nominee, no matter who wins the Republican presidential nomination. Republicans think Rubio is the most popular Hispanic since Desi Arnaz and will win back Latino votes. This is both wrong and insulting. Latinos know that the GOP's rock star supported Arizona's harsh immigration law and opposed the DREAM Act, which would have given immigrants legal status if they attended college or joined the military. They also know that Rubio falsely claimed his parents were political exiles from Cuba when they actually came to the U.S. before Castro took power. In a recent poll, only 13% of Latinos said Rubio's presence on the ticket would make them much more likely to vote for a Republican, while 46% said he'd have no effect on their vote. Memo to the GOP, all Latinos are not conservative Cubans, and we are not interchangeable. And now we will flip through the magazine to the end of the week magazine for this week, and the column entitled The Last Word. The specific title of this week's issue is In Sickness and in Health. Can a marriage be big enough, asks Susan Baer, to make room for a former husband with brain damage? On its destructive path up the East Coast in September 2003, Hurricane Isabel ripped through central Virginia, downing trees and leaving thousands without power for days, including the Meltons. From his office near the Capitol, Robert, a reporter for the Washington Post, was writing story after story about the devastation. He had spent days clearing out his own backyard and was surprised at how tired the work made him. He was working at his office on Saturday, September 20th, when his chest started to hurt. He thought perhaps he had eaten bad salami for lunch, but since he had had a heart scare before, he walked across the street to the emergency room at the Medical College of Virginia, now Virginia Commonwealth University Medical Center. He was having a heart attack. On Monday, doctors implanted a stent in one of his coronary arteries. 2 days later, on his 46th birthday, he was allowed to go home. A day later, the power finally came back on in their Richmond home. Robert and Paige were in the kitchen when Robert pulled his wife into his arms and reassured her, "Everything's going to be okay now. We got the power back, and I'm home." But the next day, Friday, September 26th, at about 4 p.m., the life they had known ended. Paige was making dinner. Nell, 18 months at the time, was in a high chair at the dining room table with Hope, who was 3. Robert bent over to scoot the high chair in and suddenly dropped to the floor. The children started screaming. Paige called 911. Robert was barely breathing, then stopped. Paige tried CPR. Neighbors came. Power crews in the area came in and tried to help. Paige remembers a big, burly man holding her 18-month-old. Still no ambulance. A sheriff's deputy came in and tried to revive Robert. He was gone, Paige says. After 3 days, Robert woke up. He was talking, mumbling, whispering, but none of it made sense. He didn't know who anyone was. Still, nurses told Paige stories of miracles, people who came all the way back. She clung to those. Robert spent several weeks at Henrico Doctors, where he had a defibrillator put in, then was transferred to a rehabilitation hospital. He'd had little physical impairment, but his cognitive loss was profound. He had severe language problems, couldn't sit still, was confused and frustrated to the point of violence, and he had no memory, short or long term. By January 2004, he had made enough progress to go home. But after about 5 months at home, the progress slowed. He could speak and read and write, but he couldn't hold on to the meaning behind words. He had little judgment or control over his behavior and was increasingly frustrated. He didn't remember his former life, says Paige, but he knew it was something more than he had at the time. Doctors told Paige that Robert would benefit from some place with regular activities and a set schedule, a routine that was difficult at home with 2 small children, as well as caregivers to manage his medications. So Robert was moved into Brighton Gardens in Richmond, an assisted living facility, and later to a similar place called Sunrise. Today he looks healthy and fit and walks with confidence. Paige makes sure he dresses well, and glasses at the end of his nose still give him a professional, professorial look. But within seconds of meeting him, it's clear his mind is impaired. It's hard to know how much he comprehends, even when he answers a question. The most striking thing about Robert is his personality. Once reserved and a bit aloof, Robert today is talkative and exuberant. He seems to spill over with wide-eyed joy and gratitude. He calls everyone darling or babe or bro. "Mabel, I cannot thank you enough for that toilet tissue," he'd say to the short Colombian woman who cleaned his room at Sunrise. Page, a journalist and political speechwriter, had made her peace with her life. She had lost her taste for politics. Half the fun had been discussing it with Robert, she says. But she worked full-time as a government affairs consultant. On the side, she became an advocate for brain injury and caregiver groups. I had made up my mind, this is what our life is going to be, and I'm okay with that, she says. She didn't go out much socially, but in June 2008, she attended her 25th college reunion in Charlottesville. At a cocktail party, she reconnected with Alan D. Ivey IV, a University of Virginia classmate she'd known since kindergarten, who was now a banker and father of four sons living in St. Louis. They had been good friends as kids, co-editors of the high school newspaper. He vowed to contact her the next time he was in Richmond to visit his mother. 6 months later, he did. And soon after, with Alan in the midst of a divorce, they began talking regularly. It was nice to have an adult to talk to, Paige says, and she began to wrestle with feelings that they could be more than friends. It had never occurred to me at that point to be in a relationship, she says. It felt disloyal to Robert. Alan realized that the only way their relationship could develop was if it included Robert. As he started falling in love with Paige, he said to her, I see this responsibility that you have, and I want to help you with it. I understand this is a package deal. That's what triggered the relationship, Paige says. He understood that Robert was central to our lives and that we needed to take care of him. Paige eventually introduced Alan to Robert, and Alan worked to forge his own relationship with Robert, writing him an email every day and taking him to breakfast at IHOP, Robert's favorite, whenever he was in town. Alan felt uneasy at first, guilty about befriending a man with limited cognition while starting up a romance with his wife. Paige tiptoed into the subject of dating with Robert, telling him that she and Alan were beginning to be more than just friends and asking if he understood and was comfortable with that. Robert told her it was fine. He's a really nice guy, Paige says, he told her. In March 2010, Alan and Paige and the girls went skiing at the Homestead Resort in southwestern Virginia. Paige watched from behind as Alan helped her daughters navigate the slopes, skiing with one girl on either side of him. It hit me like a thunderbolt, she says. I'm watching him with these two girls, and I thought, here's an unusual man, and a patient man, and a kind man, and a very loving man, and I felt my heart just lift. They started having whimsical talks about marriage, but merging families seemed too complicated. Alan, now divorced, couldn't leave St. Louis, where he had joint custody of his three youngest sons and was about to become president of Reliance Bank. And Paige's support system, her parents, sister, and brother, were all in Richmond. And there was Robert. Marriage would require divorce. Paige couldn't imagine that. But another thought eased her mind. I knew if something happened to me, Alan would take care of Robert and the girls, of course. In June, Alan proposed. Paige said yes, though she still couldn't wrap her head around how it would work. Eventually, they came up with a plan. Paige and the girls would move to St. Louis, and Robert would come with them. Paige says she was a nervous wreck on the June 2010 morning when Robert's brother Will brought him to the house. She'd gone over the conversation dozens of times in her head, but still couldn't imagine saying the words out loud. Finally, she started, I'll always love you, and we'll always take care of you. I know that, Robert said. She took a sip of coffee. You know that Alan and I have been seeing each other, and we have a relationship, and we love each other, and he's asked me to marry him. Robert responded immediately, You should marry him. He's a good guy. Then he asked what would happen to him. Paige explained that they would all move to St. Louis, where she'd already found a Sunrise facility close to their home. Their family would be the same, she told him, only bigger. Paige and Robert's divorce was final in early 2011. She wanted to remain Robert's legal guardian, as she had been since his injury, and no one objected. Will signed for Robert. On the morning of March 26th that year, Alan and his youngest son, Charles, took Robert to breakfast at IHOP. That evening, Paige and Alan married in a small 19th-century chapel at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Richmond, in front of about 100 people. As Alan held Paige's hands, he promised to always love her and her daughters. He turned to Hope and Nell, who were their mom's attendants, and smiled. Then he looked back at Paige, and I promise to always help you provide for compassionate care for Robert. In June of last year, Paige and the girls moved into the 5-bedroom ranch house she and Alan had bought in the St. Louis suburb of Crèvecœur. They outfitted Robert's room at sunrise to look exactly like his room in Richmond. Same layout, same photos, same bulletin board with number one dad sign. Everyone seems to be adapting, but Robert seems to be adapting best of all, Paige and Alan both say. He takes part in everything from the walking club to the puzzle group at sunrise. I've got the calendar of today's activities, and I've done the whole 9 yards, he tells Paige one afternoon. Aren't you proud of me, darling? Paige still sees him several times a week, taking him out to the house or bringing him iced tea for his refrigerator or books of word searches. Alan writes him emails every day and takes him to breakfast every Wednesday. For years after Robert's injury, Paige was sustained by the notion that she would see him again after she died. The man who turned her head in the press room and loved poetry and handed her their newborn babies. We'd be able to talk through all this stuff, and I'd be able to say, well, I hope it worked out okay, that the decisions were the right ones, and that you were happy. She's comforted that Robert seems content. That's what has made her own happiness possible. Friends used to assume that the holidays were the hardest times for her, but it was really the motions of everyday life. Now that's what brings her the greatest joy, making breakfast, setting the table, the long oak table from her dining room in Virginia that now sits in the sunny kitchen. There they all clasp hands to say grace before dinner. The table is big enough to accommodate all of them. This wonderful article was copyrighted in 2012 by the Washington Post and reprinted in the Week magazine with permission. And now we'll turn to the Talking Points section here in the Week magazine for this week, the week February 3rd, 2012. And the first article here is entitled The Internet, The War Over Pirated Music, Movies, and Books. Call it the day the Internet fought back, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. For 24 hours last week, some of the world's most popular websites, among them Wikipedia, Craigslist, and social news website Reddit, shut themselves down. Other sites, such as Google, blacked out their logos for the day, while 7 million people signed an online petition. This historic online protest was organized in opposition to 2 bills in Congress designed to crack down on Internet piracy. The Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect Intellectual Property Act called for a blacklist of rogue sites that allow Internet users to illegally download movies, music, and books for free, and proposed giving the government new powers to drive them out of business. But website operators said the laws would have given Congress unprecedented power to shut down any site that disseminated copyrighted material even without knowing it, such as YouTube, where millions of users regularly upload bootleg TV shows and videos without the site's consent. The resulting protests got Washington attention, and in just 48 hours, the 2 bills were dead. But the problem remains, how do you fight the theft of intellectual content in a manner that satisfies both the websites and the copyright holders? Ending the Internet revolution isn't the answer, said Gary Shapiro in FoxNews.com. Giant Media Record, or excuse me, Giant Media Record and Movie Company spent millions to create and lobby for this draconian legislation, which would have destroyed the online freedom enjoyed by millions. These companies have owned Congress for decades, persuading lawmakers to extend the length of copyright protection 14 times since the 1970s, and creating outlandish penalties for infringement. More than 30,000 Americans have been hit with ruinous lawsuits brought by recording and publishing companies, including Jamie Thomas Rassett, a single mom fined $1.9 million for illegally downloading 24 songs. Now, with last week's protests, the American people have rebelled. This wasn't a victory for the common man, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Instead, it was a huge win for tech industry giants like Google, which portrayed themselves as scrappy innovators standing up to Big Brother and greedy Hollywood lobbyists. But the bills were far more modest than this cyber tantrum suggests. They primarily targeted pirate firms in Russia, China, and other foreign countries that trade in illegal content, not Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube users. In reality, the evangelists object to the idea of copyright itself. They want no restriction on the free flow of pirated music, movies, and books. Such pirated material now accounts for almost a fourth of all internet traffic. Actually, a little copyright infringement is good for society, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. Most people who download pirated movies or music wouldn't have paid for it through legitimate channels. So these industries' claims of massive losses are exaggerated. The existence of file-sharing sites, moreover, puts valuable consumer pressure on content creators to come up with convenient, innovative, and cheaper alternatives to CDs and DVDs. Without piracy, we wouldn't have iTunes, Hulu, Netflix, or Pandora. We can live with a manageable amount of copyright infringement, just as we live with public libraries and used bookstores. Easy for you to say as a content consumer, said Peter Larangas in the New York Daily News, but piracy is killing the livelihoods of writers like me. Internet users upload and download illegal copies of my children's books every day, and the onus is currently on me to discover and report each individual theft. The ability of musicians, artists, and writers to live off their creative work is being taken away just because some sweaty kid in his mom's basement in Romania feels like stealing it and sharing it with the world. Clearly, we do need more protection for intellectual content on the Internet, said David Pogue in NewYorkTimes.com. Just because technology now makes it possible to duplicate a creative work and distribute infinite copies of it without cost doesn't mean that activity isn't shoplifting. Yet many internet activists take the absurd position that free movies, free music, free books, and free fun of all kinds are their natural-born rights, and that the big evil government shouldn't take them away. Now that Congress's sloppily worded anti-piracy laws have been killed, it's time to try again. Both sides have an obligation to do the right thing. We need legislation that would let the sharing spirit of the web flourish while protecting the rights of talented, hardworking people who create our culture's art and entertainment. The next item from the Talking Points section of the week, Paula Deen, a Southern fried hypocrite? TV chef Paula Deen can't have her cake and deep fry it too, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial when the bubbly Georgia native, 65, announced last week that she has type 2 diabetes. It set off a predictable chorus of told you so from longtime critics of her high-fat cuisine, which features such dishes as bacon cheeseburger meatloaf and deep-fried mac and cheese. Deen is hardly the only celebrity chef to whip up calorie bombs, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. But Deen knew she had developed diabetes even while getting rich off her catastrophically unhealthy recipes. For three long, greasy years, a woman whose signature dish is a burger topped with bacon and a fried egg between a pair of glazed donuts promoted the deep-fried life without acknowledging her first-hand experience of how a person can be burned by it. Stuff it, you Yankee snob, said Tom Barton in the Savannah Morning News. If Paula were some scowling Frenchman deep-frying goose liver in a high-priced Manhattan eatery, Blue State foodies would be hailing her as a genius and lining up around the block. Instead, she's a folksy, big-haired woman from Savannah who looks like she shops at Walmart. As such, she's becoming a lightning rod for the indignation of elitists who consider the South one giant grease trap, peopled by ignorant, fat, and uncouth slobs, too stupid to take responsibility for what we eat. Dean is so popular because she turned working-class American cuisine into decadent feasts fit for special occasions, said J. Brian Lauder in Slate.com. She never told anyone to eat like that every day, as Dean said on the Today Show last week after revealing her diabetes. Honey, I'm your cook, not your doctor. And now a couple of short notes as we reach the end of our program. Of nearly 400 moon rocks given to the state and world leaders after the Apollo 11 and 17 missions, almost 200 have been lost, destroyed, or stolen, according to a new NASA survey. NASA says 517 moon rocks and other astromaterial samples that were lent to scientific labs or political leaders between 1970 and 2010 also have been lost or stolen. Ronald Reagan's name was invoked 221 times over the course of the first 16 Republican debates. George W. Bush's name was spoken 56 times, while his father, George H.W. Bush, was mentioned twice. Ownership of tablets and e-readers almost doubled in the U.S. over the holidays. The Pew Research Center found that 10% of those surveyed on December 21st owned tablet computers and another 10% owned e-readers. A month later, the survey found both figures had soared to 19%. And our poll watch for this week, 58% of voters say they are very or somewhat aware of the Stop Online Piracy Act. Of those who are aware of the legislation, 68% did oppose it. And 67% of Americans say new legal limits should be placed on the unlimited campaign ad spending by super PACs. 29% favor unlimited ad spending by the outside groups. And we have just about run out of time for today's Reading of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.